free, yeah.
You are listening to KPOO San Francisco 89.5. You've reached Reality Sandwich. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant, and you are listening to our radio show, Healthful Living's radio show, Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth, where every Thursday we serve up a palatable taste of the truth on the mind, body, our planet, and all of the factors that it takes for us to sustain a healthy life on this planet. So today we have a great guest in the studio, and we're going to be talking about a really fascinating topic called nonviolent communication. Our guest today is Mickey Kashtan, a certified trainer with the Global Center for Nonviolent Communication and a co-founder of the Bay Area Nonviolent Communication, a national training. She leads public workshops and ongoing groups for nonviolent communication in San Francisco Bay Area and around the country, and offers a meditation, meeting facilitation, and coaching for private and public sector organizations. She holds a PhD in sociology from the University of California in Berkeley. Mickey, welcome.
Hi, very good to be here.
I'm glad you're here too, and I'm glad you made it safely, and I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
Me too.
So, you know, nonviolent communication, I've heard the term before. I've actually heard a bit about it, but I'm curious if you can just describe what this is to begin with, because nonviolent communication is kind of a strange way to me to describe something, to not be a particular way.
Yeah, I want to start with something about the English language, which Gandhi really lamented when his term ahimsa was translated into English. He lamented that there wasn't really a term in English that could capture that. Mm. And so nonviolence was his choice. And it's kind of striking that the English language doesn't have a positive term to describe it, because it is such a radical notion of which really is about finding a way to meet life open-heartedly, even when things are really not going your way. Because I often tell people it's very easy to be nonviolent when everybody does exactly what you want. The real capacity to have compassion is when people do things that are not what you want. And that's part of what this method allows you, is to open your heart and be compassionate regardless of the circumstances.
Wow. So I'm looking forward to this, because on my vacation that I just got back from yesterday, I was reading a book about Gandhi. So this is great timing.
Yes.
So do you know how this word that Gandhi used would have been described if we had more language? I mean, do you know how it would be translated? What the meaning really is?
It's a combination, you know, in this moment what I'm thinking of is a combination of love and courage. Mm. It's a willingness to open your heart to what happens to yourself and to other people, to love people, even your enemies.
Mm.
And that has been talked about. It doesn't mean loving what they do. And a lot of people think that it's this kind of passive, do nothing, you know, just accept anything that happens in the world. And it is not that. It's a willingness to remember the humanity of the people who are ostensibly your enemies, and ultimately to have no enemies because you recognize their humanity. So that's the love aspect. And the courage has to do with the immense vulnerability that we must master in order to meet people in this way. Because it doesn't always work your way.
Mm.
And, you know, in personal interactions, it may mean hurt and pain if you don't get your way. In, you know, in actual political conflicts, which is where Gandhi started, it may very well mean a willingness to die, which he was talking about. So it's not like in order to practice nonviolent communication, you have to be willing to die. That's not what I'm trying to say. But it takes courage to overcome the layers of protection that we put around ourselves so that we can show our hearts to other people.
Who started this nonviolent communication?
Marshall Rosenberg. He started it in the 60s, and the first applications were in communities that were trying to desegregate peacefully.
Mm.
Instead of, you know, there was a lot of conflict and adversarial experiences that people had around the time of desegregation, and this was an attempt to support communities in really working through the issues without it turning into, you know, hostilities.
Hmm. So he was, I'm assuming, from America, and he was doing
yes.
that here in this country?
Right. He was born and raised in Detroit, not the most nonviolent place on the planet. And he came at this from really asking himself the question, what is it that makes it possible for some people to not join the dance of violence and domination that has been prevalent on the planet for 5,000 years? And so he started observing what people do, and between that and readings in comparative religion and readings about Gandhi and all of that, he came up with this set of understandings that supports people in really transforming their consciousness.
Wow.
It's really an awareness discipline masquerading as a communication process.
Say that one more time.
An awareness discipline masquerading as a communication process.
Ah, okay.
So it's kind of like through paying attention to the language that you use, mm-hmm. you retrain your nervous system to respond differently, to think differently, to experience reality differently.
And what about most of us on a day-to-day level? Do most of us do this in our lives already, or do most of us not do this and have to learn this?
Here's I want to answer your question from a slightly different angle that mm-hmm. you will get at it. If you try to teach people this process, the ones who learn it fastest are the children.
Hmm.
They have very little accumulated layers of the habitual ways of doing things that we all have to work their way through. So they capture it right away. And then adults take much longer to learn it because we have been acculturated in a different way. I'll give you an example. When you were a child, or when anybody who's listening can ask themselves, when you were a child, how often were you asked, what are you feeling? What is it that you need?
Oh, yes. What? I can't remember any.
So since we are creatures of practice, if we are asked, if we're not practicing accessing our heart, we're not going to be familiar with it. So many adults, when asked those questions, have no answer because mm-hmm. those pathways have not been trained.
Right.
And that's really what it takes time to learn. The concepts are really simple. It takes very little time to really explain the concepts and the basic structure of how you can interact with people. But getting into the habit of it is what takes time and effort and learning and a willingness to really be present, to overcome all the training in diagnosing and analyzing and judging and evaluating and demanding and protecting and hiding, all the things that we do day in and day out.
Hmm. So for people that have never heard this before and someone new is coming to you or taking a class from you, what is nonviolent communication then? What are the principles?
I think I can best describe it using an example. Tell me if you're willing to, you know, expose yourself a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Tell me an example from the recent days where somebody did something that you reacted to in a way that you wish you'd reacted differently. Do you have an example?
Mm. That I wish I had reacted differently?
Yeah. Hmm. Of course, there's the wishing that they had done something different, but...
Yeah, I guess the situation where I wish I had actually stood up for myself more.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe a situation with a family member or a situation in a business situation where... I've probably had both of them, where, you know, in that moment, I wish I had maybe... explain myself more or defended myself more or something.
Okay, so do you remember what it was that the person did that you wanted to defend yourself from?
Boy, I'm I'm not remembering the specifics, but let me see if I can come up with something. Oh, you know, maybe like, let's say an uncle makes a little smart comment to you in front of other people. And then, you know, in that moment you can choose to just ignore it. You can choose to say how it made you feel or whatever. So a situation like that where, maybe my response would have been to let it roll off. Just to kind of ignore it, but then later I'm sitting there brooding over the fact that how could somebody be so mean and blah, blah, blah.
Okay, perfect example, because it immediately gets us to illustrate the point that a lot of people get confused and think that this is a training in how to be nice.
Mm.
And it really isn't, because being nice is often being dead emotionally. You protect, you hide what is really going on. So instead, it would be supporting you in finding a way to express what is true for you in a way that is not blaming your uncle.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, if the choice is between saying nothing or saying to uncle, you are mean, we would prefer to say nothing, because you are mean is not something that we want to say.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other ways of expressing what is going on in the moment. And again, without a concrete example, let's
sure.
make it up. So, you know, maybe uncle says something like, oh, you always have been like this. You've always, been saying things and meaning something different.
Mm-hmm,
I don't know.
Mm-hmm,
I'm just
okay.
making it up.
Sure.
It's probably not a great example, because it probably was something that was supposed to be funny.
Yeah, it's probably something like... one example was that one family member did one thing and then the other family member did the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, one family member eats too little, the other family member eats too much, ha ha ha, or, you know, those kinds
yeah.
of little things all the time.
Yeah. So then we have a choice. If we want, the ultimate goal of this process is to support connection. And see, if you hide something, You don't stand up for yourself, you don't express what is true in you, you compromise the quality of connection. Because now you're protecting yourself, you're hiding, you're away, you're separate, you're distant. Uncle is over there, and you are over here, and there's no connection.
Mm-hmm.
If you really want to connect, you have two options. One is to find a way to understand the humanity of uncle. What is behind this joke? What is it that he's really wanting? What is going on that's leading him to say this? Not in an analytical, condescending way, but in an attempt to really imagine what a human being could be experiencing that would lead them to do this. So maybe he's feeling uncomfortable and he wants to have some levity and easy connection in the moment. Or maybe, you know, he's frustrated because he wants people to pay attention to him. I don't really know what
mm-hmm.
it is, but when I think of it in those terms, then I can easily connect. Then I'm not paying attention to what he did, the strategy that was not fun for me, but to what might be the human landscape
right.
underneath that. And when I'm able to do that, I'm already feeling more connected and less distant.
Mm.
And then the other option that I have is to really tap into what is going on for me and express it. It sounds like that's what you might have wanted to do in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then it can look like, depending on what really was going on for you. When you say that he is mean, I'm guessing that you really want family interactions to be gentle.
Right.
And that's a very different way of expressing it, to say, you know, uncle, I feel a little sad when I hear this joke. I so much want gentleness in the way that we interact in the family. Would you tell me what was going on for you behind this joke? You're already connecting. You are speaking your truth, but in a way that supports connection instead of a way that pushes him away.
Right.
I'm wondering if this is resonating for you.
Sure. And then, part of me, I guess, absolutely, and I would dream that the interaction would go that way.
Yeah, so I'm hearing the hesitancy. Is it that you're not trusting that he can hear you in
right.
that way?
Right, yes.
So if we are really solidly situated in ourselves, if you have an understanding of what your inner experience is, what your own feelings and needs are and can kind of rest in that in a moment of what we call self-empathy. It gives you space to turn attention to understanding him. Because most often when we don't trust that people can hear us, it's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
But if we hear them first, there will be room in them to hear. So if you turn to Uncle first, if you first turn inwards, silently inside yourself in that moment of wondering, am I going to let it go or am I going to say something? In that moment, you can instead connect with, what's going on for me?
Mm-hmm.
And what would I really like to do right now? How would I really like to connect with Uncle now?
Right.
And then if you recognize, oh yeah, I'm a little hurt and, you know, I want gentleness, I can model it right now in how I respond to Uncle.
Mm-hmm.
So Uncle, you know, I'm really curious what was going on for you. Were you just wanting to have fun?
Mm-hmm.
It creates a bridge.
Right.
And those little things don't amount to anything, but the same kinds of dynamics happen at all levels. And so we get into conflicts and we don't know how to handle them, and then we back off, but there's more distance. You know, one of the places where you see that most often is in couples that stay together for many years. Mm-hmm. Often you, in the attempt to keep peace and make things harmonious and peaceful mm-hmm. and joyful, people don't talk about what's really going on. And then over time, there's less and less that you can talk about, and the relationship becomes more and more of a shell. And that happens to so many couples. And then if there is a way to open it up, which I've seen happen very often with many couples that I have worked with in the past, and they can start hearing each other, the relationship transforms and the original intimacy that was there is restored. Mm. It's so beautiful to behold when that happens.
Wow. So these principles, when I'm remembering his name, Marshall, what's his last name?
Rosenberg.
Rosenberg. When he created this, you said he pulled from a lot of different disciplines and religious studies and things. Since I just read the book on Gandhi this weekend, where does Gandhi fit into this? What's that teaching behind all of this? I'm guessing he came before this Greenberg, and so did he pull it from him?
It was part of it. I'm guessing if you look down at what does it mean to, you know, respond to enemies the way that Gandhi did. It has something to do with a willingness to recognize the humanity of somebody you're in conflict with, a willingness to really, really, really keep reaching for the absolute faith that the other person is made of the same fabric that you are. So that's one of the principles that you could say Marshall extracted from Gandhi's work. Those people are human beings, and if I appeal to their hearts, there is a likelihood that we can work things out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one principle where I see a relationship. The other principle is we can find a solution that will maintain both of our dignities, that will keep us connected, and that will be peaceful, where we both matter, where things will be working out for both of us, not just for one or the other.
Hmm.
So that's another core principle. Another core principle is a principle of focusing on what you want to create, not only what you want to oppose. So if you read about Gandhi, then you know about things like constructive program or even his acts of protest almost invariably had something that he was working towards. So when he does a march to the salt area, he is demonstrating what he wants to create. He wants to create a world in which there is access to salt for people who need it.
Mm-hmm.
So he's moving towards, not just opposing. Very similar dynamic was going on in the civil rights movement. When black and white young people entered the lunch counters and sat together, they were demonstrating a world in which black and white sit together in the same place. And so it's not just standing outside the lunch counter with a picket line saying segregation is bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's a demonstration with their bodies of what they want to create.
Mm.
So the focus on what is it that you want, what is it that matters, what is it that is important that you're working towards, that
mm-hmm.
you're moving towards, that you're longing for, that you're wanting,
mm.
is another principle, focusing on that direction rather than just opposing things.
Sure.
So those are some of the connections, and
yeah.
there's probably more.
So, you know, it amazes me because I think you're talking right now and I'm saying, wow, this makes sense. This is great. And yet it's amazing to me that we being most of us and most governmental entities, don't do this.
Well, for the last 5,000 years, more or less, we have been raised with two assumptions that make this very difficult to do. The two assumptions are, one, I am separate,
mm-hmm.
and two, there isn't enough for all of us.
Mm.
When you take these two assumptions and put them together, you have a recipe for war at all levels. Internally, between people, between nations, at all levels, we are separate from each other and there isn't enough for all of us. Then all we have is to fight with each other about what we want.
And if for a moment we assume that that's not true, that maybe we're not separate and maybe there is enough, why would these beliefs have been created to begin with?
This
is philosophy.
It's philosophy and pure speculation. You know, I could give you my 2 cents worth, and I would prefer to focus on what we do from here on.
Sure.
But I'm willing if you would like.
No, okay. I love those philosophical questions.
I do too. I think about it a lot, and I can only imagine that it was in response to crises.
Mm-hmm.
And then once it got started, it gets reproduced very easily.
Right,
because every culture reproduces itself
mm-hmm.
by how it trains the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at our child-rearing practices, you will see that people are trained to feel separate and to believe that there isn't enough. They're trained to, you know, look out for number one.
Mm-hmm.
They're trained to believe that the only way to succeed is by stepping on other people. That nobody is going to look out for you, and therefore you don't have to care about other people.
So I'm curious for those people out there that do have children, since a lot of my listeners are families. I'm curious what some of those old child-rearing paradigms are that aren't working, so people that might be out there would know what to be aware of.
I can tell you one very critical transformation is around the thinking about limits. There is a commonly, widely shared belief that children need limits. And my sister in Balkhashtan does, her primary work is with parents. And she and I have had a lot of conversations about it. There is a shift that we see possible between limits that are arbitrary and external, and limits that are natural and grounded in the needs of the parents and the needs of the children. So to say that children need limits, when I look underneath that, what I get from it is that parents want their children to understand that there are other needs and wishes and possibilities and perspectives and things in the world aside from their immediate every whim. And I want children to learn this, and I see the best way to learn it is by the adults around really modeling being full human beings that own their needs and express what they want and show the possibility of empathy, of negotiating difficulties, of working things out in a way that honors the needs of the parent and the needs of the child. And so then when there's a conflict, it's not some external thing that is between us, but an actual connection between us that can help us both see the possibility of transforming. And when I see children that have been raised in this way, I am so moved by their capacity to care about other people.
Mm.
when it comes from within and not through a should.
Right, right. Yeah, you're right. And sometimes we, I won't belabor that. That's a very good point. So how does learning NVC affect the way NVC being nonviolent communication? How does that affect the way we listen to one another and that we talk? How we talk to one another?
So when I listen to people, especially if there's any charge or difficulty, or they're saying something that it has a potential conflictual context, and I want to back out for a second and say, I only suggest that people use this where there is a reason to use it and where they trust that it can support them in transforming the situation. It's not like, go out and talk like this all the time. This is not ever anything that I would say. So go about your life, do things in the way that feels natural. Then if you see that there is the possibility of conflict, somebody says something or does something that you don't like, then I start listening for the feelings it needs that this person may be expressing underneath their words or behavior. Just like we were using in the example with the uncle. Mm-hmm. I was listening to what is it that matters to uncle? What is it that he might really want in this moment? And I find that when I listen at that level, it helps me connect with the universal nature of human needs and with the commonality that we all share of what we most want. And it's not like I want a house or I want a car or I need a chocolate or anything. It's really the basic human needs that we all share. You know, love and acceptance and understanding and meaning. All of those things, we all want them.
Right.
There are many more.
Right.
We all want them.
So what do we do when the situation is a little more violent than, say, our uncle or our grandma or somebody, and now we're talking about a political conflict or, you know, let's say, oh, here's an example. You know, we always see in the news people that are wealthy, other people trying to exploit them. So maybe a celebrity being sued for something just because they have money and someone's trying to win. How do we, you know, this is clearly a conflict, but one that I would perceive it difficult to be compassionate for the other side.
To be compassionate for the person suing the celebrity?
Yeah. So the person that's being wrongfully taken advantage of.
Okay. So if I experience the situation as this is wrong and I'm being taken advantage of, there will be no room for compassion in my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the shift is shifting away from evaluating in terms of right and wrong to trying to understand what are the needs of all the parties involved.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's a stretch. It definitely takes practice to come to that place. But if I could stretch into trying to imagine what might be going on for the person proceeding with the lawsuit, what is it that they want?
So let's say in this case they're afraid, and they are maybe afraid for their livelihood because something happened and they don't have money, so they figure this might be an easy way to get it. So I say, okay, I can maybe identify something that might be going on with this person. Again, we don't know if it's true or not.
Of course not. We don't know until we check. But rather than saying, okay, I can understand that and then move on, I want to take the time to park there for a moment and say, okay, so this person is wanting security, wanting sustainability and security. I can relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like, you know, their specific actions, but I can relate to that. I can relate to the desperation that people might feel and open my heart a little, and then I don't see them as a bad enemy.
Mm-hmm.
It changes my experience right there. Mm. Now, it gets tricky when there are lawyers involved. As I understand it, you are actually prevented legally from talking to each other directly except through your lawyers.
Oh, wow.
So, at least in some situations. So that would be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But often before there's a lawsuit, there's something else that happens.
Mm-hmm.
It may be that the lawsuit is not founded on anything material, but there is something usually that happened where there is, I'm guessing, some upset that this person has with a celebrity. I mean, of course, all this is theoretical. We're making it up.
Right, we're making it up.
you know, the person chose this celebrity and not that celebrity. So there is likely to be something about the relationship that, if it's looked at, can transform the situation.
And are we doing that for ourselves? Are we doing that for the other person? Or what's the ultimate outcome that someone might be looking for?
Okay, I can tell you, it's different things for different people.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, it's having a different foundation of self-connection that they get from doing this practice. For other people, it's an integrity with the values that they want to live. For other people, it's more of a sense of inner peace about when you perceive the world as everybody's out to get me, it's hard to have inner peace. But if you perceive the world as, you know, people with feelings and needs like me, there's a lot more inner peace that arises. For some people, it's a desire to connect with other people and understand them. So the common denominator is, I am doing it for me. I'm not doing it for the other person. Part of what I want in living in the world is to act towards other people in certain ways. And that's me. That's not about them. It's about me wanting to live in integrity with my values. It's about me wanting to contribute to other people's well-being, generally speaking. So there's a lot of things that I want that relate to other people, but it's still always about me. And how is it going to nurture me to do this other way of being?
Mm.
It can affect the quality of my relationships. It can affect my inner sense of hopefulness about living in the world. Lots of things.
Hmm. So give us some examples of situations where nonviolent communication might be used to help resolve conflicts.
Well, I already gave two, but I think I want to give a specific example with a parenting situation.
Great.
That happened to my sister and her son when he was 3, and they had guests over. And they stayed in a downstairs room, and in the morning, before they got up, the 3-year-old was banging on the floor above their head. So often what parents would do in a moment like this is, you know, grab whatever he was using to bang, and thereby, ironically, often not having the outcome they wanted, because the child would start crying, and it might be even louder than the banging.
Right.
And instead of doing something like this, she said to him, you know, when I see you banging on the floor, I am worried about our guests. I want them to be able to sleep as long as they want. Are you willing to stop banging or to bang on the sofa instead? That's a very different way of approaching it. And then when given room to really tap into himself, what he said at 3 years old was so remarkable. He said, I don't want to, but I'm willing.
Wow.
And then she said, how come you don't want to? And I said, well, it doesn't wake me up. And then she said, then why are you willing? And he said, because I want to consider you.
Wow.
At 3 years old, because from day one he had the trust that his needs matter, there was this endless space in him to hold other people's needs dear.
Wow, that's amazing.
So this is just one example of the millions that happen on a daily basis between parents and children that can really be done differently. And part of it is for parents to recognize that it's not about being empathic towards the child as a way to get them to do what you want, but it's about a willingness sometimes to not get your way as a parent, sometimes to be open enough to the child's needs that they will see that you shift. It's not about compromising, it's about really being willing to shift. And when the child has experiences that there's shift going in that direction, they are much more willing to shift themselves.
Wow. And I'm assuming that part of the thing that causes adults such a difficult time to engage in this process is probably because of some of those childhood experiences that they might have had where there wasn't shift happening, and maybe they created some beliefs or strategies.
Yes, so that it's hard for them to trust that by expressing themselves their child might shift towards them. The other thing is the reality of parenting in this culture is very isolated and very hectic.
Mm.
So it's very hard to have the quality of spaciousness necessary to have these dialogues with little ones. So I really have a lot of compassion for parents who try to create any kind of change in space in their relationship with their children as their world, you know, spins faster and faster on
right.
all of us.
Wow. So for those listening, just tuning in, you are listening to KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM, and you're listening to Reality Sandwich, and you're talking with Julie Matthews and Mickey Kashtan on nonviolent communication. And so that's what we're here today. Let's see.
I had another application
yes.
that
I would love to hear it.
Yeah, and it's very common. It's between couples. When there are conflicts between couples, they either give up or often they try to work them out through compromise. And compromise, as I understand it, is I give up some of my needs and you give up some of your needs, but neither one of us is going to be really happy.
Mm.
And it's very different from a situation in which we listen to each other's needs and understand them so fully that instead of it being a conflict between us, it becomes a dilemma that we are holding together and looking at what would meet most needs for us. When we can trust that we really care about each other's needs,
mm-hmm.
then there's so much more creativity and goodwill in terms of addressing, well, what strategy is going to be most effective to meet the most needs that we have addressed.
Right. And what do you find? You were talking earlier about humanity. You had said, being able to appeal to the human nature in others. And what have you found, or what stories have you heard about nonviolent communication being used? You know, Mike, I'm always curious, and I would think that your average person might be afraid because they feel that. They're feeling a need maybe to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of people out there that are kind of disillusioned and think maybe the humanity is not going to make it these days with the way that we're treating each other. And
yeah.
I'm curious, what have you found out about people stepping up to the plate and their human nature when this type of nonviolent communication
is
used?
Well, here's a true story that happened in England. One night, somebody came out of some event and was walking home in the middle of the night at 11 p.m. And somebody accosted him and wanted his money.
Mm-hmm.
And he took a moment, you know, before responding to notice that he was feeling scared and he wanted safety. And immediately that shifted him into a willingness to engage with a person who was insisting on getting his money.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm guessing that you are desperate and you want my money. And the person says, why are you talking to me like that? Aren't you scared?
Wow.
And he said, yes, I am scared, but I also care about you and I want you to have what you need. And here, and pulls out of his wallet, says, here's what I have, and here, have it. And the other man said, you are a good man. I don't need all this money. I need less to eat, and gave him back some of it. And this is a true story.
Wow.
So even in really kind of intense situations, with sufficient skill, you can transform them. There are people, I have a friend who is a former student who is now doing this work in Sri Lanka, helping people in really desperate, war-torn island to connect with each other despite those differences. And yes, she hasn't transformed the entire political landscape, but she's making tiny little inroads, and sometimes that's all that we can hope for, and it is incredibly inspiring to hear this. And this work is going on in I think about 40 or more countries around the world now.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, so it's far from being a U.S. privileged middle class bit of work. It's really happening all over, and there've been people across a number of conflicts, both known and unknown, that have been able to hear and see each other's humanity through this process. And the hope is that enough seeds will be planted. There are hundreds of thousands of people every year that are exposed to this work. And the hope is that the seeds will take place and eventually will transform our landscape non-violently, not through some kind of revolution or war or something like this, but through people really making a consciousness shift.
Wow, that's very amazing. How can people learn about this method, and what do you do? Do you read a book? Do you go to a class?
Well, people who, I'm guessing most of your listeners are local.
Yes.
They are extremely lucky because this area of the world has probably the most concentration of classes and workshops anywhere in the world, so people can learn it in a variety of ways. There are written audio and video materials, and there are classes all over the Bay Area that people can join, and groups, and people can get individual or couple support, all of these ways that are available through the organization Bay Area Nonviolent Communication that people can connect with. And then people can choose which way most suits them if they want to learn this.
So for people that are out there listening, what types of people typically, I'm thinking of all those people driving in their cars thinking, well, this is interesting, but I don't know if you know, maybe somebody's driving down the road and they're having a conflict with their mother, that's pretty obvious, but maybe somebody else is walking down the street and they're just really upset and they don't know why, or they're feeling desperate about the bombings that just happened in India or something. What type of person is it? People with families? What types of people?
Every type of person that you could imagine. We've had people in our trainings as young as, I think, 10. Mm. I'm talking about not somebody that was brought by their parents, but somebody that on their own wanted to learn.
Wow.
As young as 10 and as old as, I think, in their 90s.
Wow.
All classes, all races, both genders, all sexualities, working people, people who are incarcerated. We have a very, very, very rich program in San Quentin.
Mm.
There are, I think, 150 people every week who are getting training in nonviolent communication inside San Quentin. It's
wow.
Very, very moving. We often bring this training to workplaces, so if anyone is excited, you know, they can contact us and we'll send a trainer to their organization. So we've done that a lot, especially for nonprofits, academic institutions, government agencies. There really is no kind of person that I can imagine who might not benefit. And not everyone takes to it. Some people don't, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody has to learn calculus.
Right. And I would assume, you know, there's always different ways that different people might apply it later on.
Right. Some people apply it only internally, just in their own inner process, doing the translation to connect with themselves and don't change anything in how they interact with other people, and they still experience huge benefits in their life.
Interesting. So people practice nonviolent communication with themselves? Is that what you're...
Yeah, yeah.
So what would that look like? Or
it's like, you know, like, for example, if you're feeling angry,
mm-hmm.
you might, you know, check in with yourself. What is going on underneath the anger? What am I really needing?
Mm.
What is the real feeling underneath it? Because the anger is very connected to this person is wrong. It's mm-hmm. not really self-connected. So you can reach self-connection through this process and release the unpleasant, you know, intensity and charge of, you know, bah, wrong, mm-hmm. all of that. Or if you, let's say you're having self-judgment, you can connect with, you know, what the judgment is telling you about what's important to you. Mm-hmm. You can connect with what led you to do the thing that you're judging,
mm-hmm.
so that you can just cultivate in this way much more self-acceptance and acceptance of other people without ever speaking a word.
I would imagine that if we all did that for ourselves, we might not even need to do it for everybody else because we probably already would be.
You bet. I'm really enjoying seeing just how much you're getting what I'm saying. So it's really a pleasure to talk with you. I'm experiencing it as talking with a peer, with somebody who really gets it, and it's really inspiring and hopeful for me to be here.
Well, thank you so much for sharing it with me and everybody else out there. And for everybody out there, give your website.
It's www. .BAYNVC stands for Bay Area Nonviolent Communication .org, and the phone number is 510-433-0700.
Great, and we've been talking with Mickey Kashtan. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for hosting me. It was a pleasure being here, and I'm hoping that whether or not people take any training, that having been listeners to this is already going to give them some gifts.
I hope that as well. You've been listening to Reality Sandwich on KPOO San Francisco 89.5 FM. I'm Julie Matthews, a certified nutrition consultant. I'm with Healthful Living, and you are listening to Healthful Living's radio show, Reality Sandwich, a palatable taste of the truth, here on KPOO every Thursday at noon. And so stay tuned for various episodes we have coming up, from some interesting discussions on the environment and to some really amazing practitioners we have coming on talking about different forms of healing and various approaches. So we look forward to hearing from you with your thoughts and comments, and thank you for listening. This has been KPOO San Francisco 89.5 FM.